Hello there, Mormon Expression Junkies. This is your new friend, Rich, and I wanted to set the background for what you're about to listen to. It's called the Living Narrative Series. It basically is based on the Up series, where we're going to follow some of our friends, some of the people that listen to the podcast. We're going to follow their story, their journey. We're going to see what twists and turns it might take, and just try and get an overall picture of what it means to be a Mormon. So we're going to be checking in with today's guest. It's their moment in Mormonism, Chris and Alyssa. We'll also be checking back with them here shortly to see what changes, if any, have occurred. Also, if you like this episode, you and each of you should flip over to our new podcast feed, Mormon Expresses Voices. Voices focuses on anyone with a Mormon story. You don't need to be famous or super sexy or have an incredible tell. You just need to share yourself and build upon one another. And that's kind of the point, is for people to even start sending in their own interviews where people can go and connect in a empathetic way, and we can build a community on that. So if you want to be a part of Mormon Expression Voices or a part of this new Living Narrative series, please email anyone here at mail@mormonexpression.com, and we would love to hear from you. One last thing I wanted to point out. We need to make sure that everybody, tomorrow is Friday, November 18th, and at 7 o'clock we're going to be recording a live podcast. It's going to be Mormon Fight Songs for Dummies and a sing-along. It's going to be at the University of Utah Post Theater, and it's going to be free to the public. So come in business casual, or come in your muscular t-shirt, or come in your flip-flops, or in your nightie. It doesn't matter. Just come, and it's going to be a great time. So we will look forward to seeing you there.
Today I'm going to be talking to Alyssa and Chris. All right, so where should we start off? You guys were typical LDS folks.
Should we tell our pre-story?
Yeah. Sure.
Sure.
You start.
So where should I start?
Just your background, probably.
Okay, well, I grew up in the church, and I served a mission, and went to BYU and met Alyssa. I mean, it was pretty much the standard, you know, happy Mormon life, and that was it.
Yeah, I would say I was pretty standard as well. My ancestry on my dad's side go back to the pioneer days, and my mom is a convert from Catholicism. She converted when she was about 19. Other than that, my story is pretty normal. As a teenager is when I really developed a quote-unquote testimony of the church and really believed in it, had a lot of what you might call possibly charismatic spiritual experiences until recently. So, yeah.
But were you guys liberal LDS, or were you the traditional TBM who took it all literally, didn't really know anything about church history, that kind of thing?
I started out much more traditional, but as going through college and, you know, just being, you know, are having a real thirst for knowledge and curiosity and things like that, I tended to become more and more liberal. And then after meeting Alyssa, I became even more so.
So you started out then as more of a liberal believer?
Yeah, as a teenager, I was what you would call like a traditional TBM, very strict, rigid with the rules and things like that. But strangely enough, at BYU, it brought out the liberal in me. And that's when I sort of started to create a distance between myself and Mormon culture and started to not self-identify so much with mainstream Mormonism. There could be roots with that in my major, which was film studies. So it was kind of a liberal major and hung out with different types of people at BYU and had different types of professors. But yeah, started to have a little bit of a disconnect from the culture early on in the BYU years. So.
But you guys were still enough of believers to get married in the temple and have the traditional LDS life.
Yes.
So how long ago did it start to change?
Oh.
Well, it starts with Chris, I think.
It kind of starts with me. So I've always been interested in science. And, you know, as I went through the church, there were some conflicts that would come up between scientific ideas and church principles. So, you know, the idea of a global flood, Adam and Eve, you know, the age of the earth, dinosaurs and things like that. And so as I, matured in my knowledge of science and the church, I started to try to find ways to make those meld together and, you know, found a lot of really good excuses to say, well, maybe, you know, in this respect, this happened. And maybe when this prophet said this, he really was speaking as a man and that sort of thing. So I would try to find a lot of ways to think about, science and religion and bringing them together. And I thought I did a pretty good job. It wasn't enough to shake my testimony of the truthfulness of the church at the time. So
did you feel like you were really good at understanding Joseph Smith's whole, what does he call it? That truth could be circumscribed into one great round. And I understand how all this fits together and all of that.
In some parts, yeah. But in many parts, I would just say, well, this doesn't quite fit now, but our understanding of science is imperfect and our understanding of church is imperfect. So, at some point in the future, maybe after I die and get to talk to God, I'll have all those questions answered and I'll have everything figured out.
Gotcha. But yeah, the cracks began to develop, I would say.
Right. I mean, it, yeah.
I remember when I was in college, I would have conversations with my dad when I'd be like, that whole, those people who learn anything they're wise, it's such nonsense. My biology classes, and I was a biology major, my biology classes aren't swaying my testimony. They're making me understand everything better. And yeah, so I understand where you're coming from, like where you're trying to make everything fit. And you know what I mean? Like there was even a point in time where I thought, well, the ark could have like carried vessels or vials of DNA.
Oh,
you know what I mean?
That's a good one.
Right?
I like that.
So, yeah, I think that's probably something a lot of people can identify with. So mm-hmm. You started out like being interested in science and trying to fit everything together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I think there's a lot, side note, but I think there's a lot of research out there that says that when people experience cognitive dissonance about their religion, and if they can find a way to like rationalize it, the brain will reward it with dopamine or something like that mm-hmm. to say, yeah, that was awesome that you found a way to make the connection work.
And in some ways, it makes you even stronger, you know, in your beliefs
right.
and things
it
like that.
It made me a little bit arrogant myself. I don't know about you guys, but I was like, oh, I am so smart.
I'm like that.
So did you start reading about science or what started happening to?
Yeah, well, my major in college was science related. Mm-hmm. And so there were a lot of studies there. And, you know, a lot of my professors would be like, you know, evolution is true and it fits with the gospel somehow and
we'll
just deal
it
with
later.
It. Yeah, we'll figure it out. But afterward, when we lived in California for a while and Elisa was she would work and I was a stay at home dad. And so I spent a lot of time listening to audiobooks and podcasts and a lot of science-related ones. And I came across The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins. And I almost didn't listen to it because I, you know, was kind of worried about, you know, reading. It wasn't specifically anti-Mormon literature, but stuff that might challenge my testimony. But I thought, you know what? The church is true. My testimony is strong. No matter what I listen to, I can make it through. And so I read The God Delusion, and at the beginning it says, you know, his hope is that by the end of the book, you'll be an atheist. And I finished the book, and I wasn't an atheist. But it had a lot of good points. And so I would think about, you know, the claims that he made in there and the different perspectives that he had, and I would start to try on these atheist glasses and see what the world looked like from those perspectives. And so I started looking at the world that way a little bit more.
Yeah. And then, I think at one point, I don't know why, but we decided we wanted to start reading the scriptures more together. Am I jumping ahead too far?
No, that's fine.
Is this about right? Okay. We decided to start reading the scriptures together more. And Chris was like, hey, just as an experiment, let's try reading the Book of Mormon and discussing each chapter from an academic perspective. And he would call it putting on the Dawkins lens. Let's try like looking at it from a believer lens, but then let's try looking at it from the Dawkins lens and see how it holds up. And so we would read the Book of Mormon together every night and discuss each chapter. And as we would do that, we would just come across so many logical problems or quandaries that were, that didn't make sense about the Book of Mormon, things that were a little bit disturbing or things like that. And at that point, it really started to kind of sink into me. I was like, this isn't adding up. And we didn't make it very far through First Nephi. I think we made it as far as like Nephi's dream, to where I was like, this stuff is offensive to me. And I started to experience a bit of a crisis of faith. Like, is this really real? None of this is adding up for me. So at that point, like, we kind of teased that. So Chris had been driving this road so far alone. And then I take the wheel and go, I'm taking over at this point. And I started just like reading voraciously all the stuff that I thought was verboten before. You know, Mormon study stuff, like Joseph Smith biographies, things like Mormon Enigma, David O. McKay and the Rise of Modern Mormonism, stuff like that. I decided I'm just going to dive in and read everything, and I don't care what it is, and I'm just going to weigh it all. And I had full confidence that the church was going to come out, you know, fine in the end. Like, if the church was true, it was going to stand up to academic scrutiny and things like that. Unfortunately, that wasn't the case. it didn't stand up to academic scrutiny in my mind. And I just began to find myself spiraling more and more, like, as a believer, like, this isn't working. I always used to express my belief in terms of percentages. Like, I believe that the probability the church could be true is 70% or something like that. And then by October of 2010, would it be?
Something like that.
I was hovering at about 30%, I would say. And that's when the infamous Boyd K. Packer talk, a general conference in which he said that why would a loving God make somebody born homosexual or something like that, born gay? I forget his exact phrasing, but and I was like, wow, that to me was the end. I was like, this, he's not a prophet. He's just a man, you know, who's just talking about the way he sees the world as himself. He's not, you know, he's not, help me out here.
Like. Yeah. Well, and you know, while you were going through this, you would bring up things that you were reading and say, can you believe this? And I had been putting on the atheist lenses for so long that I was kind of, you know, yeah, the church probably isn't true, you know? And so I would say, yeah, I guess that fits everything. And I guess the church just probably isn't true.
Yes. So you didn't feel like, oh my goodness, what did I start here by using the wisdom of man to read the Book of Mormon?
Not really, no, because it was such a gradual process for me. You know, just gradually looking at the world and seeing what it would be like, and then be like, huh, well, I guess if the church is wrong, then the world would be like that. But if the church was right, it would be this way. And so, you know, held those opposing views for long enough that it was when the time came where Elisa was just like, you know what, I just don't think it's true. I was able to say, yeah, it's probably not. You're right.
Yeah, so it's nice that we were able to go on that journey together. Like, I would share with him what I read and things like that, and we'd talk about it and make sense of it all. But after the general conference at that time, I decided, all right, I think we're going to eventually leave the church is kind of what I was thinking. And I was like, okay, developing all these exit strategies in my mind. What's the best way to make a clean exit from this? And I figured that, one of the best ways would be to probably start by just gradually warming my parents up to the idea, that I wasn't going to be a member of the church forever and stuff like that.
Right. Because I was like, you know, we could be members of the church forever. I don't really mind going to church. I don't really believe it, but it's not bad. You know, it's kind of fun to see people make claims about the Bible, but then really know that, oh no, that's not the way it was written, put together, and you know, bring some interesting things to church, to the conversations at church. But,
I think I remember you telling me that you liked stirring the pot a little bit. You told me a story, or maybe Elisa told me a story about the Good Samaritan story.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, we would be at church and they would talk about the Good Samaritan. And what I did is, you know, it's really interesting that when I started to lose my testimony is when I started to become really interested in the church.
Mostly from an anthropological perspective.
Yeah, all of a sudden it became fascinating.
Right, exactly.
I agree, it really is.
I especially found the Bible to be really fascinating because before it was just like, oh yeah, the Bible, we believe the Bible to be the Word of God and all that, but we didn't really go into why the Bible was written the way it was and how it was written and how it was put together. And so I started studying these things and just found them fascinating.
Like
and
you picked up a copy of the NSRV.
I purchased the HarperCollins Study Bible. And so I'd bring that to church. And it's cool because it has tons of footnotes. And one of the footnotes in The Good Samaritan was that when the people came and the
priest and the Levite.
Yeah, the priest and the Levite. They passed by the man who was injured, and they made a special mention that there are biblical
laws, just basically saying you can't touch a dead man,
right?
You know,
it defiles something,
right? Mm-hmm. And so, and especially for priests, you can touch it. And so, you know, I brought it up because I thought this would be interesting, and I said that this would be, you know, that they were following the law of Moses.
Yeah, it was because they were being too strict in their understanding of the law of Moses that they decided, I don't even want to risk helping this guy because if he's dead, then I could become unclean.
Right, and that totally plays into Christ's main message of not following the law of Moses so strictly that it prevents you from being a good person. And, you know, I thought this was a great insight, you know, very, you know, it fit in with everything, but it wasn't the direction the teacher wanted to go. And she just kind of glossed over it.
Yeah, that happens all the time. He'll bring up something that kind of stirs the pot, as you say, and she'll always like work around it somehow and dodge
it. Right.
And I guess we can talk a little bit about that more when we get into our relationship currently with the church and our callings and things like that. So,
but you were basically at the point where you could see yourselves leaving the church, I guess.
Elisa,
I was talking more for me. Yeah.
Like, okay.
We kind of made a little bit of a pact to leave together and,
like a Mormon church suicide pact.
Yes.
Yeah. So that we would stay or leave together. And, we're still practicing as of today. I should mention that. Still going to church, I don't know. Do we want to start getting into what our current relationship with it?
I think I want to talk a little bit about why it was difficult for us to, like, for some people, they stay because their spouse is in the church. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so with both of us, you know, losing our testimonies, why would we continue to stay? And I think one of the main reasons is our parents. Definitely probably more for me than for Elisa.
That was it for a long time, right?
Yeah. For a long time, it was that, you know, I didn't want to hurt my parents. You know, they are very Mormon.
Super Mormon.
Yeah.
So is the rest of your family all very good?
Yes.
Believers.
Yes.
All
it's funny. Yeah. On my side of the family, we have some really strong church members. And, you know, especially in my immediate family, the extended family, not as much, but in my immediate family, you know, everyone's, you know, married in the temple and gone on missions and, you know, raising kids and everything's good. My younger brother is in the high council, you know, and so he's.
Your dad's been branch president, bishop several times. Your mom's Relief Society president right now.
Yeah. So.
So it wouldn't be enough if you just went inactive. That would devastate them in and of itself.
Well, yeah, exactly. The church is so much a part of their lives that it's hard to even talk to them without talking about the church. And so, you know,
especially your dad. I mean, the church is his life.
Yeah.
Literally. Yeah. I mean, he has nothing else.
Mm-hmm. So I would, you know, and when we talk in family things, we always bring up the church and that sort of thing. So,
yeah.
So you were trying, you decided it wasn't true, but you were trying to figure out how to stick around and make it work for family
relations. Yeah.
And does your family live locally?
No. And that's the weird thing is that, you know, I mean, we could stop going. And for a lot of people who live out of, you know, their families live out of state, they wouldn't even notice. But because we keep in touch and because the church is such a big part in their lives, it always comes up. What'd you learn at church today? You know, how's
and
your calling going?
And if you don't know what the subject was in Sunday school, then like you're outed, right? That's how I feel.
Right. Well, and you know, I hate lying, you know, to my parents and that sort of thing. So,
oh,
so much character for so long. I was like, oh, what would the lesson be about in Sunday school today? And I'd like look it up in the manual in case my parents asked me. Well, you know, it was an all right lesson.
It's pretty funny.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so
dress up in a shirt and tie when we talk to him on Skype.
So what started happening after that? Did you eventually change to want to stay for yourselves, or what's happening there?
Well, yeah, so we eventually decided that, you know, again, to live lives of integrity, you know, we felt that we should leave the church at some point, you know, that, yeah. Tell a little bit about some of the problems would have.
The church has been a struggle for me because having its truth value, evaporate has made my charity towards the church evaporate along with it. Like things that I would have just rolled my eyes at before in the culture or things that people say, normally would have just rolled off my back, you know, or I would have been like, oh, that was an asinine thing to say. But I have found it a lot more difficult to tolerate that kind of thing. Since losing, my faith, it's just been so much more difficult to endure Relief Society in particular. Maybe it's my own perception of it, but it feels to me like, the Orwellian, moment of hate, you know, every Sunday where, like it just turns into these women just like saying these extremely catty or vicious comments about the world we live in sometimes. And it's so difficult for me to sit and listen to all of that. Like for example, when we talked about Boyd K. Packer's talk in Relief Society, like there were just some really uncharitable things said about gays in that discussion. And mm-hmm. I tried after the meeting was over to kind of, form connections with some of the people who had made some of the more, visceral comments, trying to say, hey, here's some of the things that here's some studies that I've looked at that say that homosexuality may indeed be a biological factor. How do you
make
sense
of that?
Yeah,
look, this one's by a BYU professor.
Yeah, stuff like that. I was like, what do you make sense of this? Them not being able to kind of even consider that possibility to me made me kind of lose some interest in the church. Like, I think I could stay if I felt that I could be an influence for good in my ward, but those kind of moments made me feel like, wow, I can't change people's hearts and minds. So why am I here? It's just been a lot more difficult to be charitable towards them.
Right. Well, didn't you also tell me at some point in the past that you have you struggle with the prescribed role for women in the church?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, I've always been a feminist, some degrees more or less. Mm-hmm. I've always just kind of took women's rights for granted. I think it was the way my parents raised me, and so it's just been really bothersome for me to realize how much women are not in power in the church, like that women have virtually no role in much of the decision making that takes place on ward levels, on stake levels, and of course on the general level as well. Mm-hmm. That to me is really disturbing, things like that. So yeah, all of those have just really bothered me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So how about, should we go on to where you, or how you kind of got to where you're participating for yourselves today?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure. So at one point we did tell our parents. Elisa told them first, and they didn't take it very well.
Well, the weird thing about them is, like, I thought I was being clear in how I communicated, like, I don't believe in the church anymore, and I don't know how long I'm going to continue to be a member. I was just trying to say it as soft as I could. I also made a point to really not say why I didn't believe the church was true anymore, because I don't want to force, a faith crisis on anybody unless mm-hmm. they choose it for themselves. I want to mm-hmm. respect people's beliefs. Maybe I communicated it too softly, but my parents didn't get the message for whatever reason. And they just thought, oh, well, she's just having a little drop in her testimony and things will go back to normal over time. Their response was to, like, let's go out to lunch and just chat. So we would have just a few conversations. And every now and then, like back in February of this year, I was talking with my mom and somehow it all came out and I said, I don't think I believe in God anymore. And she was so upset by that she made me make a pact with her to go to the temple every week to do an endowment session for 6 months. And I was like, oh my gosh, really? You want me to do that? That just sounds horrible. I did it for like about 2 months and I was like, I cannot handle this anymore. It's not doing what she wants it to do. It's not increasing my testimony in any way.
Well, in fact, it was making it worse because the pain, the inconvenience of having to go every week just turned you against
it would make me so upset as I was driving to the temple, like, rah, 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 I have to do this mm-hmm. terrible thing just to make my mom happy, rah, 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 you know.
Especially where you weren't getting anything in return. Like if it was somewhere that made you feel better or brought some sort of peace or any, even if you didn't necessarily believe it, if it was adding to your life, but if it's just an inconvenience and you hated being there, then
yeah, I think the potential for you know, having it help out your life or enlighten you in some way would have been helped if you didn't have to go every week.
Yeah. I did find one way to cope with it, which was to meditate during the parts where I didn't have to have my brain engaged. You know, there's a few parts like that where I would just like sit and just not think, like try to empty my mind, and it would be a little restful. That was kind of nice. But other than that, it was a really frustrating experience, and it was hard not to be very upset about it. Mm-hmm. Anyway, and then like about a month ago, one of my sisters must have noticed that I wasn't wearing my garments anymore and told my mom about it. And she called me and we had a huge fight, gigantic fight. Like I am not typically a very emotional person, who yells or screams or things like that. But I was pretty upset during that conversation and things like that. We just had a horrible fight. But then my maternal grandmother died like 2 days later, so that cleared everything up. Suddenly we never talked about it anymore. Mm-hmm. And so I really don't know where my mom and I are at right now. But so the family dynamics have been rough. Anyway.
And on my side, it was rough the first time I told them. I waited until they visited because I wanted to do it face to face. And then, you know, I just basically told them that I wanted to start it out as kind of like a easing them into it. So I started with, I'm kind of struggling a little bit, you know, mm-hmm. I'm in my beliefs, but they kept asking probing questions until the point where it's just like, I just really don't believe in God so much and that sort of thing. And so, it was really rough for the first, you know, for the rest of the trip, basically, that they were out here. But now it's kind of an unspoken thing. I think that they still hope that, you know, I'll come back and, you know, we're still going to church. And I think that that gives them a little bit of hope, which.
Yeah. And that's your family's culture of not really talking about the problem. My family is much more hands-on. Let's duke it out and fight this problem through the end.
So do you think perhaps that going to church is, in the future going to continue to fuel problems because they're going to see it as justification for their side of the equation or their side of the.
I don't think so. I think mostly one of the reasons that I continue to go to church.
Yeah, why do you continue to go? I really want to hear this.
Okay. So one of the reasons that I continue to go to church is because I want to, in a way display to my parents that I'm giving it my best shot. And so, you know, just kind of if we stop going, I want it to be kind of just slow and steady and, you know, gradual.
So you still might exit altogether at some point.
Yeah.
Possibly. Like, there are social ramifications. Like, we like being able to get people from our neighborhood to babysit our kids on occasion. And we might not be able to do that if we, right. You know, so we want to give the appearance of either being lukewarm in our commitment to the gospel or inactive. Like, but we don't want to appear to be apostates because we don't want to, you know, become social pariahs.
Yeah, we do have a number of friends who are in our ward, so you know, we don't want to lose those friendships.
Yeah, and we
or
like
them.
They're great. Yeah. Anyway, but it does it creates an interesting, like, I have this little personal blog that I haven't shared with anybody, but it's how I kind of cope with going to church. Mm-hmm. I write about like the feelings and experiences that I have going to church that I can't talk openly about. Like, and one of the things that I think that there's a couple of things. I think when you go through a period of loss, such as through divorce or through death like a loss of your testimony, I think, falls in this category as well. You go through the Kubler-Ross stages of grief, and like my two ways of coping with my loss of faith have been through depression a little bit, but also through through bargaining, like having like finding ways like, oh, maybe I can make it work for this reason, and maybe I can make it work for this reason, and then I kind of go through these emotional roller coasters going through church. But one thing that I've kind of felt is an interesting experience being a non-believing practicing Mormon is this sense of double consciousness. I think am I getting too abstract here? Okay. W.E.B. Du Bois is the one who invented this term to kind of describe the experience of being black in America, like being knowing that you're a good person but not being accepted or valued by your society. He used that to talk about the black experience. And this was in 1890, so he's very perceptive. But I feel like that's kind of what it's like to be a non-believing Mormon. Like this sense of, like belonging to neither world. Like we went to Las Vegas a couple of weeks ago and I didn't feel like I really belonged there either in the world. And, still too Mormon for that. But also not really belonging to Mormonism either. And also seeing myself as a believer would see me, like, as a despicable thing, but knowing that I'm not a despicable person. So that's been an interesting experience to sense that double consciousness as a practicing non-believer. So
double consciousness meaning how you perceive, explain that a little bit more.
Oh, sure. Let me read. W.E.B. Du Bois says, it's a peculiar sensation, this double consciousness, the sense of always looking at oneself through the eyes of others, of measuring one's soul by the tape of a world that looks on in amused contempt and pity. One ever feels his two-ness, an American, a Negro, two souls, two thoughts, two unreconciled strivings, two warring ideals in one dark body, whose dogged strength alone keeps it from being torn asunder. So, and I've kind of just, as I wrote here in this blog, sorry that I'm a writer, so I express things in writing, but, like, for example, a little while ago, I was talking on the phone with my Relief Society president. She was just talking about, the people I visit teach, and one sister is basically, does not want me to come visit teacher. And I was expressing that to my Relief Society teacher, and she said, "Oh, well, Elisa, you need to keep trying to make contact with her because you're one of the strong ones and she's one of the weak ones." And I'm like, so if I left the church, you'd think of me as one of the weak ones, and like feeling that sort of inner cringe about like being able to see myself as other people would see me, being able to consciously be aware of that, but also like, am I making sense?
No, you're making total sense. That's okay. One of the things that I have the biggest, it's one of the things that causes me the most anger or the most frustration with, the plight of the apostate is that a lot of times people walk away from the church because they feel they have to be, ethical. Do you know what I mean? To have integrity. And in that moment, all of a sudden they are treated as if they have no integrity. All of a sudden in the eyes of everybody around them, they have become a person who lacks any sort of moral fiber. They're accused of all sorts of sin.
Yeah.
They're untrustworthy. You know what I mean? Spouses who once loved you start treating you as if you're capable of cheating on them or abusing them or being a bad spouse. So I totally understand what you're meaning. And I think that that would probably be a frustration for anybody who stays in the church. Have you guys like tried to get into resources like Stay LDS or NOM or anything like that?
Yeah, I've read the Stay LDS, and for a long time that sustained me and gave me hope that I could try that path. I think one reason that I find it difficult for a number of reasons is that the church no longer feels like a safe place, a place that's home, anymore. Like it feels like if people really knew what I really thought, they would reject me. And so I have to be dishonest and have to, put up appearances and appear to be something that I'm not, that kind of thing. And also it's, I feel that the church creates this kind of, culture in which intellectualism is not valued, and people who ask questions and deep things are chided or derided or something like that. And as a result, the people who are the people like me, the people mm-hmm. who enjoy talking about deep things and analyzing things from multiple perspectives, aren't here anymore. They're, you know, I go to ex-Mormon parties and I'm like, wow, these are my people, the ones who like to think about deep topics and read and like to discuss cultural aspects of Mormonism. These are my people, not the ones who are sitting on the pews next to me.
Right. Yep. Right.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So have you guys had any worries about or any struggles about teaching morality to your children or how you'll raise your children or for your relationship as well? Have those views changed or?
Not so much. Having kids is interesting. And taking them to church. They enjoy church for the most part. We have a 2-year-old who just loves nursery, but what isn't there to love about nursery? And then our 4-year-old, it's interesting. He used to have a really hard time with it.
He used to fight going to church so much. He would cry and dig in his heels as we would walk towards primary. And my heart would just break for him because I'm like, I don't want to be here either, little guy. I understand. But he got a new Sunbeam teacher and she's been working magic and now he wants to go all the time.
Yep,
and
he loves it.
He wants to talk to us about God all the time. It makes me kind of uncomfortable a little bit.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting because he will ask us directly, you know, questions about God and
like, does God like being wet? Stuff like that. And I'm like, I don't know. Is God tall?
So, you know, we've had to, you know, it brings up an interesting question of how honest are you with your kids about this issue that you're still in a way kind of struggling with, not really struggling, but just that you have to live with the complexity of being in the church, but not of the church.
Oh, what an interesting phrase. So your kids are 2 and 4-ish, mm-hmm. somewhere in there. Are you worried about what might happen in the future with baptism and things like that?
No. I mean, if our son still continues to really enjoy church and just want to go every week and he loves his teachers and he loves being with his friends, you know, I'd be willing to support him in that and, you know, continue to take him to church. And we'd still talk to him about stuff. Personally, I think he's going to out us at some point.
Yeah, like all last weekend when Chris's mom was watching the kids, he was like, Mommy and Daddy don't believe in God. Mommy and Daddy don't believe in God. Stuff like that.
Yeah.
She didn't like that very much.
But. Yeah. But, you know, he says that he believes in God and grandma believes in God and stuff.
And I tell him it's okay to believe in God and it's okay not to believe in God. You can do what you want, really.
So are you worried about the church? I don't want to use the word indoctrination, but are you worried about them?
You could use the word brainwashing if that's any better.
Well, are you worried about putting your children in an environment where they could become the type of people at church that bother you so? Do you know what I mean? Like, you worried about them becoming like young earth creationists who, you know, are 4 prop 8?
Not really. I think that our influence will outweigh that. You know, I don't see, you know, once church gets boring for him, it's not going to last. And it gets boring pretty much, you know, in a couple years, it'll get boring, I think. And he'll, you know, he won't want to go. And you know, at that point, we'll probably not want to go either.
And you know, I'm a little odd, but I don't really feel like I have an antagonistic relationship to the church. I don't really resent my upbringing. I don't really resent my Mormon lifestyle that I've lived up to this point. And I wouldn't be upset if my children choose that lifestyle for themselves. I would hope that we could be like that we could have frank discussions about some of the problems of Mormonism and things like maybe it's because they're boys and not girls that it's a little bit easier since the church is much more hospitable to men than to women, but that's kind of something we've communicated to Chris's parents. Like, you can talk to them about the church and we won't be upset about it. Just be aware we're going to show them all sides of the issue, you know, and let them make the decision for themselves. But
yeah,
it's not something I worry so much about. In some ways, I worry they won't understand the culture that Chris and I came from. So I don't want to shut it in a box and pretend it never existed. Mm-hmm. I kind of want them to understand it too. Plus, since we live in Utah, it would be a real social disadvantage to not have them have some interaction with church members in some ways.
Yeah, definitely.
Anyway. Yeah, I think that'll be an interesting thing if this keeps going through year, you know, goes forward for years to see how things change or if they do as your children get older. Cause I've heard stories of people whose youth leaders, their children's youth leaders start trying to like pick up the slack for the bad parents. And all of a sudden it creates this tension with the children about, you know, like all of a sudden mom and dad aren't trustworthy sources of information and that kind of thing.
And I feel really disturbed thinking about a priesthood leader sitting in a room with my 12-year-old boy asking him about sex. I mean, in any other context that we would be like, why in the world would you let your child do that? I don't really want my child to be in that environment for one, but yeah.
Well, there are a lot of people who are trying to change that. You know, I mean, they're not like outwardly saying this policy needs to be changed. They're just going to their bishops and saying, you won't interview my child without me present type of a thing.
Mm. Yeah.
So yeah, we'll have to see how that goes.
I could possibly see us turning into one of those people.
So any existential struggles about morality or whether I have a friend who her and her husband no longer believe in marriage. They're contemplating getting a divorce because they think marriage is a bad thing.
As an institution.
Yeah.
No, I really enjoy being married.
Yeah. My marriage is one of the best things about my life. So that's not an issue for us. I do struggle a lot with death, you know, and contemplating the afterlife. I haven't struggled with it so much lately, but there have been times when I'll wake up in a cold sweat, like, I'm going to die one day. I'm just going to cease to exist one day. And that is not a pleasant reality to come to terms with. But that's been my biggest struggle.
As far as morality goes, I think we had a kind of our morality was based outside of the church before we lost our testimonies. You know, we understood that morality is about being nice to other people and doing what, you know, you would want them to do to you.
And one of the positive benefits of losing your faith, and I think other people have expressed this, is that you start to take inventory of what things do I really believe? What things do I really value? And it makes you take ownership of those things. And that can be a very valuable process. I mean, the church does not have a monopoly on goodness and values and virtues, you know.
So, what does being Mormon mean to you guys now?
It's a good question. I still believe that Mormonism is the TBM way. A lot of people bring up ideas of being culturally Mormon, and I guess if you want to use that term, that's fine. But, you know, in a way, I kind of feel non-Mormon in a little bit. You know, I understand that I grew up in a Mormon culture, but, you know, it doesn't define my life as much.
So you're saying you don't really self-identify as Mormon so much anymore?
Yeah, not as much. No.
Yeah. It's funny because like I said, when we were in Las Vegas, you were having those like Mormon bells and sirens going off when we were smelling cigarette smoke. And so I just think it's funny to hear you say that, but
Well, you know, and it's, I don't know. I guess it's just a label that I don't know that I want to, you know, I see how I would define a Mormon growing up and I definitely don't fit that definition anymore. So maybe that's why.
Yeah, I could see that. I think, I don't know. That's a tough question for me to answer. Like, what does it mean to be a Mormon anymore? I'll have to think about that and get back to you on that one. I haven't thought about it too much.
Okay. So have you guys actively planned on where you're trying to see yourself in the next little while? What you're trying to work on and change or?
We're kind of working on ways to maybe get out of our callings at this point. I'm an elders quorum teacher.
And I'm a Relief Society teacher. And in fact, that's what my blog is about, which is here's what I teach in church and here's what I really think in some ways. And it can be difficult sometimes. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Well, and I think it's especially difficult for her because in Relief Society, as opposed to Elders Quorum, in Elders Quorum, you have basically a bunch of young guys. And in Relief Society, you have a real spread of younger and older.
Yeah, more
women.
Conservative with the more younger progressive, if you could call it that.
Right. Yeah. So I think it's much more difficult to teach. She also has more people to teach too, where I have a group of maybe 15 at the most.
Sometimes it's really fun and exciting to bring in my worldview into and express it in Mormon language, like talking about feminist topics, like in Mormon terms sometimes, you know, that's kind of exciting to get them talking about feminist issues, even though they don't realize they're talking about feminist issues in my class, stuff like that. But I think my New Year's resolution is going to be to find a way to smoothly transition out, possibly with the calling and possibly keeping the kids home and stuff like that.
Right. I still kind of enjoy doing my lessons. Sometimes they're a little rough, but
Chastity, that wasn't very
Chastity
fun.
was kind of interesting, but still, you know, I didn't talk about abortion or homosexuality, but I was able to talk about, you know, the importance of not committing adultery. And I like to bring in like scientific and secular studies about how to avoid adultery. And let's see what some of the other ones I will sometimes bring in sometimes like a little subversive thoughts that I pose as deep questions to ask. And so, you know, when we talked about baptism, I was like, what is it about 8? Why does the Lord choose 8? You know, it doesn't seem like 8-year-olds can make good decisions, that they're mature enough to do that. But why would it be 8? And when you're talking about faith, I brought in a die, a die, mm-hmm. and I rolled it. And I was, well, before I rolled it, I said, "Brethren, I have faith that I'm going to roll a 6. And I rolled it, and it wasn't a 6. And so I picked it up. I said, "Brethren, I have faith that I'm going to roll a 6. And I rolled it, and it wasn't a 6. And it took like about 6 or 7 times before actually a 6 would roll up. And I was like, ah, there we go. You know, I have faith.
Confirmation bias.
Yeah, well. And
I forget, what was the response to that?
So what it was is that there was a quote from the manual that said, "Faith is the belief in things that are not seen but are true," right? And so I didn't see what my role was going to be. But for the first, you know, 5 or 6 times, it was not true. But the last one, it was. So did I not have faith the first 5 or 6 times and only on the last? Or, you know, what does that mean? And we were able to have a little bit of a discussion on that. And so
it's an interesting exercise in hearing them rationalize their.
It is, because sometimes they'll come up with some good things. Sometimes they come up with scary things. So I just taught about chastity, mm-hmm. the law of chastity. And I asked, why is it that it's second to murder? You know, I mean, really, is masturbation worse than arson? You know, is
or kidnapping or child abuse?
Yeah, is looking at porn worse than child abuse? And you know, it was interesting to see him rationalize, and we also talked about adultery and what the biblical punishments were for adultery, and it was death. And I said, why don't we do this anymore? Why, you know, the Lord obviously still believes that adultery is bad. Why don't we have the same punishment? And one guy actually suggested that. If our society, you know, it was because of society, and that if society was different, we would still kill people
wow.
for adultery.
I can't believe that.
And so, you know, sometimes I will, you know, stir up the pot a little bit and it'll turn against me. I'll be like, oh, okay, well, let's move on.
That happens for me sometimes too. Like somebody will say something and I'll just give them a blank stare like, wow, you said that. Okay.
So have you come up with anything that you just can't teach? Have you come across anything that you just can't?
Well, again, you know, when teaching chastity, there's a big, long section in the lesson about homosexuality, and we just skip that.
Yeah.
Same thing with adultery. Or not adultery, sorry.
It's always
abortion.
A challenge. I go through about, like, several hours before preparing the lessons of just mentally getting myself ready to do the task, just because I find it to be anathema sometimes. But, yeah, anyway. Mm-hmm.
I think for the most part, I can find something of value that I believe in that match mm-hmm. with my values and teach mostly that.
Yeah.
You know, mostly talk about that sort of thing. You know, with
missionary.
Same
for me, I can find something redeeming about yeah. most of them.
Missionary work was kind of hard because it's all about, you know, spreading this gospel that I don't necessarily believe in anymore. So with that one, what I brought, I produced a graph of the church's growth. Mm-hmm. And if you look at it, the church's growth is going down you know, relatively lately. And so I'd be like, so brethren, why do you think it's going down? And, you know, try to discuss about that and that sort of thing. It's funny because people will come up to me and be like, that's just such a great lesson. You're such a spiritual teacher.
And I know, I get people crying and like hugging me like, yeah, that was the best lesson ever. And I'm like, that's so funny because I don't believe it.
Right.
Anyway.
Okay. So we've kind of gone over. Well, and you haven't really decided what Mormonism means for you, and so
still working it out, yeah.
But and you're still active for now, but at some point in the future, you see yourself out.
I see that in the cards. Yeah.
I see it happening. Yeah, I mean we're already dropping a little bit of the orthopraxy. We'll shop on Sundays periodically.
I know.
And really looking back, it'd be like, you know, that's probably the dumbest commandment, keeping the Sabbath day holy. It's really meaningless. You know, a lot of other ones are based on morality and have, you know, really, you know, negative consequences. But Sunday, really?
Well, I think the Sabbath day is about creating a sacred space, you know, like in the way that we decorate our houses at Christmas time and we make the environment differently. It causes you to think about your world differently. So I see some value in the Sabbath day for that. But if you don't believe in God and the need for having a sacred space, then it is kind of meaningless, yeah.
Right. And like Lisa mentioned, she stopped wearing her garments. I still wear mine just because I don't want to go out and buy new underwear. yeah. So.
Well, we even have, like, you have an would we call him a Jack Mormon co-worker?
He's an ex-Mormon.
And he wears a white t-shirt just so that nobody has to ask questions.
He has the line.
Right.
Like that. Yeah.
How about tithing? Are you guys still paying tithing?
No.
Yeah, we dropped
that. That was something we fought about for a long time.
Right.
Did your definition of 10% change?
Yes.
Yeah.
Over time?
For the first part.
I was really pushing that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, and you've been taught these things all your life and, you know, it's just a habit. And to stop doing them, you get this little pit in your heart and you're like, oh, I don't know if I should do that.
Tithing for me was easy to drop.
Yeah. It was a little harder for me, but I'm not the one who pays the bills.
The church has an estimated net worth of what? Like 600 billion or something really huge like that. Mm-hmm. They don't need my money.
You know? For me, what it was, the reason why tithing was such a struggle for me was the temple. If you don't pay tithing, then you can't go to the temple. And mm-hmm. I hadn't told my parents, and I wanted to still continue to be in the temple, be able to go to the temple. Elisa has a sister that isn't married. And so,
That's going to be fun.
Yeah. I mean, we, at some point early on, we were like, okay, well, maybe we can hold out until she gets married and then, you know, move out. And so, you know, when you stop paying tithing, that kind of drops out. You won't be able to go to the temple. So I was trying to hold on to maybe that for a while.
Yeah. For a long time, we were keeping all the do questions on the temple recommend, the things that you could do. Mm-hmm. But once we stopped paying tithing, I was like, well, I can probably let go of some of the other ones, like garments and things like that.
Yeah. For a while there, you know, I would say that, yeah, we're totally temple worthy, except for that first question.
First couple of, yeah.
Yeah.
So do you guys currently have temple recommends and you're dreading the renew?
Yeah,
so we're waiting for the renew and we probably won't.
Next year.
Yeah. We just probably won't get them renewed.
Yeah, we probably won't show up for tithing settlement.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So you haven't had the pressure laid on you about from your church leaders?
Not yet.
As far as our ward knows, like, we're all good.
Yeah.
Like, yes, they don't suspect a thing.
Yep.
Until they listen to this right now.
Yeah.
All right. Well, is there anything that we haven't covered that you wanted to talk about this evening?
Can't think of anything.
I don't think so. I think that pretty much sums it up. You know, I like to take things slow, which is one of the main reasons. Elisa, like she said, when she took over, she's like, I'm driving, let's go.
Leroy Jenkins.
Yeah.
People probably won't get that joke, but.
I like to take things slow, and that's part of it, is that I'm on my way out, but I'm on my way out in a pace that I'm comfortable with.
That's something that's really nice about the dynamics of our marriage. You know, like, I'm the one that pushes us to make decisions, but Chris says, hold off, let's think about it. Let's weigh our options first. That's kind of a nice thing.
Right. Yeah. So when you do get all the way out, and you're no longer active, you're not, you know, everybody knows, are you going to take the step of having your name removed from the records?
Haven't thought about it.
I've debated about there's pros and cons to both, you know. At this point, I'm leaning towards the inactivity slide out of the church. That's kind of where I'm leaning towards.
Yeah, again, we don't have like a real anger toward the church. We're not mm-hmm. leaving because we're offended or because we're upset. We just don't believe. And so
then it must be because you want to sin, right? If you're not offended.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, lots of sins out there that we'd love to do.
That's funny. Like, we go to parties with coworkers sometimes, like where there's a lot of alcohol and we're still abstaining and things like that. But
yeah,
they make fun of Chris because he's like, when I do try alcohol, I want to do it with like clinical testing. Like, we want to see like how many drinks, what effect it has, and only one of us can drink at a time so that we can measure the other person's effect. We haven't crossed that boundary.
Yeah,
yet.
Yeah.
So do you think removing your names from the record, your names from the records, would that mean anything?
Well, and I think that's probably why I don't feel like I want to, is because if the church isn't true, you know, if it has my name on the record, it doesn't really matter. You know, I think maybe at some point there would be something that comes up like, some general
like
authority.
Like another Prop 8 might.
Yeah,
might
another Prop 8 would be something like that, or some general authority will come out and say that science is the devil, and I'll just be like, that's it. But, you know, I don't care enough to take it out at this point.
The question for me is, does it actually do anything?
Yeah. Don't they still count you, like, in their numbers?
I don't think we have any way of knowing, but my guess would be that it doesn't. The reason I haven't done it
moves you from one list to another.
Exactly, like you're a bad. You go from a bad Mormon to a very bad Mormon. Like, you know what I mean? They don't actually remove your name. But.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for the conversation. I think Rich's plan is to follow up with you guys in several months, a few months. I'm not sure, just to mm-hmm. see if things have changed. You know how your lives are going.
Yeah, this is going to be like a project to just kind of see how our attitudes towards the church evolve over time, I think.
Yep. Right, kind of those longitudinal studies that monitors like children development, so they get a bunch of babies and follow them over several years.
Yeah, I think when Zilpha and I originally talked about this project, we were using the 7-Up documentary mm-hmm. series as our inspiration, which they take these 14 kids and they interview them every 7 years to see where they're at in their lives. And they're up to their 50s now. Fascinating documentary series.
Yeah, any of you who are listening who haven't seen it, check it out. It's really great.
One of the best documentary series ever. So,
all right. Well, like I said, thanks for being here. And as always, the discussion continues at MormonExpression.com.